It's great to be invited to a church where some of our children and grandchildren worship. There's nothing that gives the satisfaction in life to see your loved ones continue with the Lord. And we praise God for the opportunities of service that the church has provided for them. My text this morning is found in John 1, verse 18. 1, verse 14. The Word became flesh and lived for a while among us. We have seen His glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. One of the surprising things about John's gospel is that it doesn't mention the transfiguration of Jesus. All the other gospels, Mark, Matthew, and Luke, do. We might have expected John to emphasize this narrative because he is very interested in the idea of glory. He uses the noun glory 18 times, which is nowhere near Paul's total of 77, of course. But it is more than in any of the other gospels. Luke uses the word only 13 times. John uses the verb to glorify 23 times, while no other New Testament writing has it more than 9 times. Now, these statistics show that John sees glory as one of the important elements of Jesus' life. We might reason that it would be intelligible if John had included the transfiguration story with its revelation of Jesus' glory, and the other three had omitted it. But in fact, it is the other way around. Matthew, Mark, and Luke tell us about it, and John, for all his emphasis on glory, omits it. It simply wouldn't fit into what he is saying. His idea of glory cannot be concentrated into any one incident. He has the distinctive idea of seeing glory everywhere in Jesus' life. And he starts out with the reality of the incarnation. The Word became flesh. He's writing about one who is supremely great. He has already said that the Word was in the beginning, that the Word was with God, and that the Word was God. He has used the Word as a name for one who is as great as can possibly be imagined. There is no way of thinking of anyone or anything as being greater than the Word. The Word is true God. But John is also saying that Jesus is true man. The Word became flesh. He came right where we are. He took our nature upon him. He underwent all that being human means. He didn't play at being a man. John is writing about a genuine incarnation, miracle of miracles. The Word took upon him our flesh with all that that means. He accepted the limitations that are part and parcel of human existence. John doesn't spell out what those limitations are, but his choice of words leaves his readers in no doubt about the real humanity of the Word. He became flesh. Not only so, but he lived among us. John's verb, skenoo, is connected with the Greek word for tent, skene. Or as some prefer to put it, tabernacle. Some understand John to mean he pitched his tent among us for a while. They see the picturesque phrase as pointing to a temporary dwelling. Of course, the incarnation was a temporary thing. Jesus didn't live on earth as a man forever. But we cannot get that out of the verb that John uses here. While it referred initially to living in a tent, it later was used of a permanent dwelling. For example, it is used of those who dwell in heaven in Revelation 12, verse 12, and there is nothing more permanent than that. Now, to Jewish minds, the reference to tent brings the thought not of a tent, but of the tent, or tabernacle, which they read in their Bibles. In the wilderness wanderings of their ancestors, the place of worship was a tent called the tent of meeting, or the tabernacle of the congregation. Moses refers to that in that way in Exodus 33. It was a very holy place. And quite plainly, the Israelites in the wilderness looked on it as a very significant place, a place where they could meet God. Now, when the tabernacle was first set up and was ready for worship, a wonderful thing happens. We read in Exodus 40, "Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Moses couldn't enter the tent of meeting because the cloud had settled upon it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle." That the Lord put his seal of approval, so to speak, on the place of worship meant a great deal to the Israelites and subsequent generations. Love to dwell on the way. The glory came down. This was not just an opening celebration, for at a later time, the glory of the Lord appeared. To the people at the same tabernacle. You read about it in Leviticus 9. Now, the Hebrew word for tent is mishkan, which is related to Shekinah. For later generations of Israelites, This term Shekinah often referred to the glory of God as it is manifested to men. They saw it as bringing out the truth that God gloriously dwells among his people. At any time that he chose to make that truth manifest, he might do so by some public showing of his glory. This happened at other times than the setting up of the tabernacle. It happened, for example, on Mount Sinai, where the glory of the Lord settled on Mount Sinai. For 6 days the cloud covered the mountain. To the Israelites, the glory of the Lord looked like a consuming fire on top of the mountain. It happened again during the wilderness wanderings, at a time when people were ready to stone Joshua and Caleb. The glory of the Lord appeared at the tent of meeting to all the Israelites. Numbers 14. And that, of course, put an immediate stop to the premeditated murderous enterprise. And it led on to the revelation that the glory of the Lord fills the whole earth. I wonder when you drove to church this morning, you were overwhelmed by God's affirmation and confirmation of the resurrection when you saw the buds and the new leaves come out of trees that looked as dead as a doornail 4 months ago. John is saying to his readers then that the glory that had been manifested in one way or another in the wilderness wanderings and later at the dedication of Solomon's temple that you read about in 1 Kings chapter 8 was manifested in its fullness in the life of Jesus of Nazareth. All the previous manifestations had been partial. Now came that manifestation that was appropriate for the only Son from the Father. Ramsey, a Bible scholar of bygone days, says of the use of the term here, "We are reminded both of the tabernacle in the wilderness and of the prophetic imagery of Yahweh tabernacling in the midst of his people and of the Shekinah which he causes to dwell among them. The place of his dwelling is the flesh of Jesus." And he goes on to say, "All the ways of tabernacling of God in Israel has been transitory or incomplete, or all are fulfilled and superseded by the Word made flesh and dwelling among us." Miracle of miracles. Now, to set up the tabernacle and later of the temple tells us something about the glory of God as the Jews understood it. The architecture of the temple taught them something about the greatness and unapproachableness of a holy God. There was first the outer court. There was no problem with that. Anyone could enter. Even the Gentiles. It was even called the court of the Gentiles. And then came the court of the women that marked the farthest point the ladies might approach. And the court of Israel likewise stood for the limit beyond which the gentlemen of Israel might not go. And a common feature of the tabernacle and of the temple was the court of the priests, into which no layperson might go. It was set apart for those who had been admitted to the sacred priesthood. It was the holy place. Hebrews 9, verse 2 speaks of it. Finally, further on, there was a place too sacred even for the priest to enter, the Holy of Holies. This was entered on only one day in the year and by one man only. On the great day of atonement, when suitable sacrifices had been offered, the high priest entered this very holy place and carried out prescribed rituals. So it was required that he take a censer and incense, and then he came inside the curtain that marked the Holy of Holies. He was to put the incense on the fire before the Lord, and the smoke of the incense would conceal the atonement cover above the testimony so that he wouldn't die. The way the place of worship was constructed and the restrictions placed on access to the holy place and to the Holy of Holies emphasizes the greatness and the majesty of God. The worshippers were not to presume that they had the right to approach God when and how they pleased. Even the priests were limited, and of course lay people even more so. That God's presence was among the people was not in doubt. That people could approach that presence as they chose was not a possibility. Perhaps that is a lesson we need to relearn in our day. God is a great God. Man as such has no right in God's presence. We often behave as we can do as we like with God. I read about a church that had a sign outside. The church is open. Come in. Sit. Pray. It is never too late to talk to God. And then, underneath, they were inscribed in small letters, hours 9 a.m. to 12 noon. We do that with God, you see. We say wonderful things about him. We say that he is great and wonderful and mighty. But then we act as though he were subject to our control. We even determine how he is to be approached and, of course, arrange things so that he is not going to be too hard to get along with. But we cannot do that with God. The Old Testament teaching about God's glory should warn us away from our common approach. God is wonderful, majestic, a glorious being. He may choose to manifest himself to men, even to dwell among them, but that is for him to say, not for us to decide. There was a glory associated with the awe-inspiring spectacle of Mount Sinai that impressed on the people who saw it. their own littleness. Just read Deuteronomy chapter 5. There was a glory associated with the tabernacle that could even restrain a murderer's impulse. God is glorious, but man may not presume in that glory just because God is pleased to manifest it to them. They must retain a proper awe. Now John is well aware of what the Old Testament says about God's glory, but he is not simply repeating what the Old Testament says. He is saying something new. He says not only the Word became flesh and lived among us, but also we have seen his glory. What then, I ask you, what did they see? They saw the carpenter of Nazareth. They saw a man who brought cheer to some lowly people at a wedding in an obscure Galilean village. They saw one whom Nicodemus thought he could patronize. They saw one with whom an unimportant Samaritan woman argued, and for that matter, did many Jews in Jerusalem. They saw one who healed a lame man by the pool of Bethesda and was promptly denounced by that same man to his enemies. They saw him defend himself and his attitude toward the Sabbath. They saw him feed a multitude of people with a few loaves of barley bread and some small fishes. And then go on to be quizzed by an ignorant crowd of people who challenged him because he had not brought a manna from heaven as Moses did. They heard him speak at the Feast of Tabernacles and were interested spectators of the controversy that resulted. He healed a man born blind and stirred up more controversy. He raised Lazarus from the dead and stirred up yet more controversy. And as John comes to the climax of his narrative, he tells of a long talk Jesus had with his disciples in the upper room. A talk that they clearly didn't understand as they should have. And then he was betrayed into the hands of his enemies by one of his followers and disowned 3 times by another. Finally, he was tried before the Roman authorities, with his own people bringing the accusation. He was nailed to a cross and left to die. John goes on to God's vindication in the resurrection and tells of how some of Jesus' followers saw him again. He relates a moving story of the way in which Peter was restored to the place of leadership, and then of how that apostle immediately presumed on his place to poke his nose into the affairs of another follower of Jesus. The Gospel of John is an interesting account with many ups and downs. It certainly is a long way from being a straightforward account of glory in anything like its Old Testament sense. Jesus doesn't appear as a lofty, unapproachable person, secure in his majesty from all assaults of his enemies. On the contrary, he is despised and opposed. And in the end, his enemies get him. They crucify him. This is not the way we understand glory. We can make sense of glory in the way we see it at the Transfiguration. There we have Jesus overshadowed by the bright cloud and with his face shining like the sun. His clothing was white as the light. White as no one on earth could make it white. There were the heavenly visitors, Moses and Elijah. And the voice from heaven saying, "This is my beloved Son." That is glory that we can understand. But the carpenter, using a hammer and a chisel and a saw, what is glorious about that? That is no more than ordinary, everyday stuff. It happens all the time. It is the same as Jesus' entire life. We can pick out a few glorious moments, but for the most part, we couldn't call that life glorious. What, after all, did he do? He preached to a number of people in an outlying province of an ancient, long since vanished empire. Even there, he was not often in the capital, the center of affairs, but in a remote country area. He taught a few people, gathered a few disciples, did an uncertain number of miracles, aroused a great number of enemies, was betrayed by one close follower and disowned by another, and died on a cross. Where is the glory? Centuries before, the prophet Isaiah said of him, "He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows, familiar with suffering, like one from whom men hide their faces. He was despised, and we esteemed him not." That's the kind of life that John is writing about. Word became flesh, as he was. But in the kind of life he lived, he had, John says, "We saw his glory." John is telling us that God doesn't need tinsel. There is no need for the outward trappings of majesty and pomp for God's purposes to be carried out. God doesn't see things as we see them. The trouble with our vision is that we instinctively look for the glitter and the show. Public recognition and praise are important to us. We expect people to bolster their egos with claims to magnificence. We are a little like that famous opera singer of years ago, Jan Klepura. It is said that on one occasion he complained to his publicity agents that another opera singer was getting much more publicity than he was, and he didn't want to be robbed of his share of glory. And his agent said, gently but firmly, "Sir, the trouble is that the gentlemen of the press think that you are conceited, and therefore they don't care to write about you." And the famous singer was incredulous. He sighed. "Conceited? Me? The great Clepura? That's the way it is. We don't want people to miss our greatness, even though our circle be a lowly one. We want all the accolades and the credit to which we are entitled, and a bit more if we can get it. We insist on living, on being recognized, and are upset when people don't accept us for what we think we are." John is saying that God is not, and Jesus is not like that. Real greatness does not need to assert itself. Real glory is not to be found in pomp and circumstance and pageantry and show. That is just so much glitter. It doesn't matter. Real glory is different. Real glory is to be seen in lowly service. When something must be done, and someone so great and high that he need not do it, nonetheless leaves his exalted place and does the lowly thing, that John is saying is glory indeed. That is the kind of glory that John's gospel describes. It is that glory that we see on every page, right at the beginning. John has left us in no doubt about the greatness of his Lord. The Word was in the beginning. He was with God. He was God. And it was that Word, that supremely great Word, who lived on earth in lowliness. Where people needed help, he helped them. Where they were sick, he healed them. Where there were ignorant folk, he taught them. Where there were hungry people, he fed them. All the time he was seeking the needy. He didn't haunt the palaces of kings and governors. He was not found in the high places. The earth. Perhaps we may fairly say that people in such places felt that they had sufficient resource and could cope on their own. It was not to such that the Word came. All his life he was among God's little people. Those who, in one way or another, felt their needs. And wherever there was such a need, he was found doing lowly service. That is what Christ came to do. And that is glory. You see why it would have been difficult for John to have included the story of the Transfiguration? It would have represented an attempt to concentrate in one incident, the glory that John sees has spread through a whole life. It might have given a picture of glory in the sense of majesty and splendor, while John is not denying that there is a certain truth in the traditional understanding of the term applied to Jesus. He is saying that real glory is not to be found in splendor, but in humility. True glory is seen in lowly service, and John sees it in every moment of Jesus' lowly life. Particularly does John see the glory in the cross. That was very hard for first century people to take. For them, the cross was an instrument of shame. There was nothing glorious about it. We Christians don't easily see the cross that way, because from early days, we have been conditioned to see it as wonderful. We have made out of it an ornament. We work it into the wonderful designs of the interior and the exterior of our places of worship. We wear it around our necks. We see it as a proper object of art. Innumerable artists have painted the crucifixion. The contemporary Red Cross is a symbol of humanitarianism. To make the sign of the cross is for many a very pious religious act. Others reject this kind of symbolism, but we accept as our basic truth that it is the cross alone that gives us hope for time and for eternity. It was on the cross that our salvation was wrought. Piety, art, and humanitarianism combine to make the cross a valuable symbol. But people in the first century did not see the cross that way. To die on a cross was a painful, so painful that someone has called it the acme, the highest point, the perfection of the torturous arts. The weight on the body, on the arms, the pain of the wounds, the constriction of the lungs, the flies and the thirst, all those combined to make crucifixion one of the most uncomfortable way of dying that man has ever devised. The pain of it all was obvious. But many saw the humiliation involved as even worse. Crucifixion was considered by the Romans the most shameful way of dying. A Roman citizen might not be crucified, no matter what he had done. While that law was occasionally broken in the empire, its force was clear. This was not a noble way to die. A Roman might be executed, but it would be in some honorable way, for example, by the sword, as the Apostle Paul was. There was no honor in a cross. Crucifixion was for slaves and outcasts. It wasn't for good, honorable people like Roman citizens. Yet John saw the cross of Jesus as glory. He tells us that Jesus introduced a teaching on his death with the words, you find them in John 12, verse 23, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified." William Barclay comments, "Jesus didn't mean by glorified what they meant. By glorified, they meant that the subjected kingdoms of the earth would grovel before the conqueror's feet. By glorified, he meant crucified. They defined glory as triumph. Jesus defined it as service." So for John, the cross was not shame. It was glory. It was the glorious way in which God's Son brought life to people in darkness and death. It was glory because it was the way in which the ultimate service was given to sinners. John reports the words of John the Baptist, "Look, the Lamb of God that takes away the sins of the world." By his lowly death, Jesus dealt with the problem of the world's sin. John doesn't tell us why this should be the way that sin is dealt with, or how the death of the Lord, of the Lamb of God, takes away sin. It's enough for him that this is the way. Jesus must die to put away sin. John tells us that Jesus spoke of being lifted up from the earth and adds, "This he spoke of signifying by what death he would die." John saw the death of Jesus on the cross as the supreme example of glory, not as the shameful thing his contemporaries thought it was. Jesus lived a life of humility, of lowliness, of rejection. And then he accepted the most shameful of deaths. In that way, he performed the ultimate service. He took away the sin of the world, your and my sin. John is saying that this is what real glory means. Jesus had no need to come to earth. He might have retained all the joy and splendor of heaven, but he left it. And when he came to earth, there was no necessity for him to live in poverty and rejection, but he did it. And when he came to the end of his life, he was not compelled to die the painful and shameful death of the cross, but he did voluntarily. Would anything be more glorious? John speaks of this glory as full of grace and truth, full of unfailing love and faithfulness. By his taking the lowly way, the way of real glory, grace became a reality for mankind. John introduced a tremendous concept, one which is at the heart of the Christian faith. It is at the heart of the faith because it is by this glorious act of Christ that people are brought into salvation. This is a concept that is also at the center of Christian living. And by grace, through faith, we have come to understand the meaning of the death of Jesus We see that for us, as for him, real glory is in humble, lowly service. The Christian way is not a way in which we look for people to praise us, to recognize us for what we think is the full extent of our merits. Real glory is rather in finding some useful piece of service, no matter how lowly, and doing it as well as we can. Unless we see that, we don't understand what Christian service is. The call to Christian service is not a call to occupy some comfortable and eminent place. It is not a suggestion that if we go along in the right way, everyone will speak well of us. The call to Christian service is a call to take up our cross daily, to walk in the steps of him who for our sake took up his cross. If you do, the glory of Christ will become apparent and will be seen through you as he graciously works out his purpose in and for and through and with your life. Closing, I would like to remind you of the words of Jesus. If any of you wants to be my follower, you must turn from your selfish way. Take up your cross daily and follow me. If you try to hang on to your life, you will lose it. But if you give up your life for my sake, you will save it. What do you benefit if you gain the whole world but lose your own soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and my message, the Son of Man will be ashamed of that person when he returns in his glory and in the glory of the Father and the holy angels. And he's going to return for sure. What do people see when they look at your life?